from noon to 1. And then from noon to 1, we will be with our speaker. And then from 1 to 1:30, we'll open up for another discussion time when we can share more. So our speaker, is our speaker here? I don't see her rectangle. So why don't we spend some time responding to Barbara's focus that really brought us into this topic so beautifully, and even the reflections of what change you have, a change you have seen, give a lot of people a chance to chime in if they want, a change you have seen in your lifetime as a woman, or something that resonated with you, or a question you might want to ask Barbara. So we'll open it up until Linda comes. Who would like to start? Well, I'll add something. I was seeking a divorce in the 70s. And when I read the divorce agreement that my lawyer had drawn up, it was full of that language, husband and wife. And there was a way that it sounded that just gave me the chills. And I said to my lawyer, this won't be isn't okay with me. I can only go forward if you go through the whole agreement and put our names in instead of this archaic language. Just the language was so uncomfortable to me. And she had never had that request before, and it was a little strange for her. She was a woman, I think, who had kind of moved ahead in her life through adding some patriarchal pieces to herself. And that's something we've seen too. But she did acquiesce and she did change all the language and it felt much better. So that's a story. Susan, you're muted.
I wanted to ask Barb about the effect of her brother on the way she thought about being a woman in society. Did she compare herself with him, or he older or younger? And
So my brother is 7 years younger. So I was always the big sister. And yes and no. Certainly growing up, no. At this point in time, yeah, maybe. He became a very successful lawyer. He is very different from me in terms of the things he values. And like most siblings, if you ask them about, the house we grew up in, you would think we didn't grow up in the same house. He came away with a very different feel of everything, and that absolutely altered who he was. So in, I don't know that I can really answer that, Susan. I very much respect professionally what he's done. I have worked really hard to try to figure out a way into his psyche to let him understand that there are things besides money and status, because I think because he saw life very differently. I felt very secure growing up, even though my father died when I was 11. He did not. He didn't, and he did not remember his father. And he just felt, but interesting, one of the things, if we're in terms of what we're talking about, my mother made a major effort to put him, position him to become the man of the family. So, and we ate out less after Dad died, but we still ate out once in a while. So when he's this little kid of maybe 5 or 6, she's sending him in to pay the bill. She's giving him the money and sending him in to pay the bill. And there was a whole lot of that going on. So in some respects, my mom's parenting was extraordinarily different between the two of us. And would it have been that way if my dad had lived? That I really don't, I don't know, but what I saw in terms of the situation we had, it was very different. Susan, I'm not sure that's a good answer to your question, but that's what comes to mind.
Thanks, Barb. So we want to welcome Linda. Hi, Linda. We have spent this half hour with Barb. She's given us a focus talk to kind of bring us into the topic, and she's taken us through the decades of her life as a woman and where how feminism grew and what's changed up until this date. So we want to welcome you. We'll be hearing from you from 12 to 1, and then at 1 to 1:30, we'll open it up to a group discussion. So, Linda, is it Liu? Am I saying that right? Yeah. Linda Liu is a lecturer of sociology at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. She teaches and writes about feminism, neoliberalism, cultural studies, and film and media studies. Her work has been published in Camera Obscura, Feminism, Culture, and Media Studies, and New Review of Film and Television Studies. She serves on the executive committee of the faculty staff union at UMass Boston and is active in labor struggles to improve higher ed working conditions. She lives in Dorchester with her partner, Joe, baby daughter, Lilla, and cat, Hermes. So we welcome you, Linda. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Everyone can go on mute while Linda's talking. Yeah, thank you.
Yes, thanks for having me. So how shall I begin? Okay, so okay. So I want to begin by saying that I'm speaking to you not as an expert who has the answers to the problems we'll be discussing today, but rather as someone who's in the thick and throes of mothering a baby daughter, her name is Lila, while juggling full-time work. In fact, this talk itself was written in some stolen moments between class preparation and baby care. After nights of sleep broken by teething and crying bouts. And as I try to and inevitably fall short of achieving the ever elusive work-life balance that working mothers hear so much about, it's enough to imagine getting through one day at a time and aim for the hopefully soon to come a horizon of getting a full night's restorative sleep. Another point of fact, I met my colleague Muna Killingback in a work email exchange where I disclosed that I was a new mother just returning to work from parental leave and that for these reasons, I had to be realistic about how much work I could take on top of my contracted teaching duties. So basically, I was telling her that I had to say no. And she responded with good grace by inviting me to an event and recommending me for this talk, which I found refreshing and sympathetic. Muna also relayed how rewarding she found it to be a mother and have an interesting job, which continues to be reassuring and inspiring to me. So even though I teach and write about feminism and gender, it is on the basis of shared struggle and solidarity as women, workers, mothers, and caretakers that I speak to you today. So when I think about the topic of today's talk, feminism's gains at risk, I can't help but think of the challenges ahead for my daughter. Fortunately, she was born in a country where the wage gap between men and women has been decreasing, particularly between young women and men. Feminist movements have won women rights and shifted gender norms and attitudes, and women are even outpacing men in getting college degrees. In the grand scheme of things, we reside in a wealthy first world nation where gender discrimination is legally barred, and women have risen to leadership positions in numerous occupations and institutions. And yet, my daughter's also growing up in a country where abortion is no longer a right in many states. The maternal mortality rate is the highest among wealthy industrialized countries. There is no federally mandated parental leave. Childcare costs are prohibitively high, and mothers who take time away from work to care for children still continue to incur motherhood penalties in their careers. Many women who don't want to bear and birth children are now being forced to. while those who choose to do so are faced with gestating and caring for children in one of the least maternity and family-friendly countries, policy-wise, in the industrialized world. For families who, for whatever reason, live far from friends and relatives, raising children can be a stressful, time-consuming, isolating, and costly endeavor. While some parents pay as much for childcare for their preschool-age children as their housing, others have to quit their jobs simply to be able to care for their children. And while many of our institutions and cultural attitudes have become more oriented to equitable divisions of caring and domestic labor between men and women, women in heterosexual partnerships still disproportionately take on the lion's share of such work, which still remains largely invisible, unwaged, and devalued. To take my own line of work as an example, academia has not been very conducive to women's, and particularly mothers' success. I'll always remember how one of my female colleagues, while working to achieve tenure at a prestigious university, concealed her pregnancy and arranged with her husband to be the primary stay-at-home parent. Another professor friend who works at an ununionized university did not have any parental leave after the birth of her two children, and during the COVID pandemic had to take an unpaid leave of absence for a semester to be able to care for her baby and help her older daughter with remote schooling. She is one of the few younger faculty in a department comprised largely of older men who did not see the need for parental leave. Nowadays, in addition to teaching and helping dissertation advisees, she tries to squeeze in her own scholarship after her two young children have gone to bed, sometimes working into the wee hours of the morning and waking up at dawn only to do the whole thing over again. When she has to do academic work during the day, she hires a babysitter or has her mother drive an hour to her home so she can haul herself away for a few hours to do the kind of focused mental labor she can't do while with her kids. These women are surviving, if not always thriving, in work environments that are not amenable to having children. Multiple studies have shown that the pandemic has exacerbated already existing gender inequities in academia, with female faculty having written significantly less papers than male faculty during COVID lockdowns. Moreover, years of research have shown that female faculty often find it hard to balance work and family, resulting in what's called leaking from the academic pipeline when workers exit academia altogether. According to one study, married female faculty in the sciences with young children are 35% less likely to get tenure-track faculty positions than married male faculty with young children, and 33% less likely to get tenure than single women without young children. The colleague I mentioned earlier who hid her pregnancy did go on to get tenure, publish a book, and earn multiple accolades, but she had to work as if she did not have a family while her husband took on the bulk of the domestic and childcare duties. And this is just female faculty who are already on the tenure track. About 70% of faculty in higher education in the US do not have tenure track jobs, which means they are either working temporary adjunct positions with little to no job security and benefits, working part-time or in somewhat more secure positions with lower pay than tenure-track faculty. It's no coincidence that the balance of the faculty positions became more precarious in the last several decades, just as more women and people of color diversified the faculty ranks as well as the student body. Much like feminized industries like journalism, the majority of jobs in academia became less prestigious and lower paid. Competition for increasingly scarce tenure track jobs is intense, with candidates having to be willing to relocate anywhere in the country if not the world, in order to have a fighting chance. Which means that having other life priorities, like being your extended family or opting to live in a major metropolitan area, could deal serious blows to one's likelihood of landing a tenure track position. Yet, despite these structural inequities, the standard of the ideal worker, that is unencumbered by family and devoted above all to one's work, still dominates in academia. Tending to be a self-selected rule-obeying bunch, academics for the most part do not buck the status quo and are guided by myths of meritocracy, no matter how much their own scholarship might critique existing power structures. A common solution, if one's career isn't advancing, is to work even harder, subject oneself to ever more stringent regimes of self-discipline. Women especially feel compelled to find themselves lacking and work more, to believe that they can have it all by doing it all. There may be, to put it mildly, something wrong with all this. My work, which is committed to and motivated by feminism, is involved with examining and critiquing personal problems that appear to be individual and seeing how they're related to broader social and cultural structures. Of particular interest to me is neoliberal capitalism, this moment of neoliberal capitalism and its cultural impacts and manifestations. How since the 1970s, increased privatization of various public institutions and services have increased the onus on the individual, and that the individual has come to be expected to take responsibility for such things as getting a higher education, family welfare, healthcare, and how this is led to the weakening of collective structures and movements for change. How these developments have affected women, cultural images, and discourses that call on women to fashion themselves in certain ways is one of my particular interests. So, for instance, how have American cultural discourses named, diagnosed, and proposed solutions to problems of inequality? What are the possibilities and limitations of these? Just to take one example, has anyone heard of Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, Women Work and the Will to Lead? Okay. So my apologies first if you really like that book, but I have some criticisms of that book. Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In exhorts women to put our feet on the gas pedal. To sit at the table, reach for advancement opportunities, to not be afraid of being ambitious and thereby risk not being liked. Women are holding themselves back through their internal reluctance and lack of confidence at work by the constant consideration of when and how they're going to start and raise their families, how much they'll have to step back when they do start to raise their families. As the scholars Rosalind Gill and Shani Orgad have argued, Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In is part of a broader cultural imperative for women to be more confident, to find the problems as residing within themselves and the solutions as needing to come from internal fixes and changes. Through what Gill and Orgad call technologies of the self. So I think some of you or most of you know Sandberg's major points, but I'm just going to sort of summarize them really quickly. So Sandberg in Lean In believes that we need more women leaders, that that the top leadership positions are disproportionately inhabited by men. And so women, in order to get there, in order to get to those leadership positions, they first need to overcome the internal messages, the internal voices that hold them back. Without doing that, right, there cannot be equality between men and women. Women should voice their struggles in the workplace always instead of being quiet. Sandberg believes that acknowledging external barriers to women's equality are, of course, important to fight against. But then she says that her own work, Lean In, is about how individual women can adjust themselves to climb higher in their own job contexts. And Sandberg believes that true equality cannot be achieved until there's equal pay for equal work and half our institutions are run by women and half our homes are run by men. She believes that women need to pull each other up and that the more women there are in leadership positions, then that will result in a fairer treatment for all women workers. Now, Susan Faludi, who I think some of you might know as the author of the book Backlash, right? Are you aware of Susan Faludi? Okay. All right, so Susan Faludi had a criticism of Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In, and I'm just going to quickly summarize that. So Faludi critiques Sandberg's Lean In and how genuine it is to feminism. So Faludi says that Sandberg only focuses on internal problems rather than external structural problems and does not really acknowledge ordinary women and is only directing her book to other credentialed, highly educated corporate women. Faludi reminds us that real feminist movements start from women's collective actions to fight social oppressions and injustices. And that although Sheryl Sandberg calls her her Lean In book, right, as the kind of instigator for a Lean In movement, Faludi says that this is not really a collective women's movement. And she refutes some of Sandberg's specific claims about female leadership. So Faludi says that just because a woman is in a leadership position and has power doesn't necessarily mean that she will help other women to also advance, or that she will mentor other women. And that was kind of an assumption of Sandberg's book. And Faludi says that lean-in feminism de-emphasizes structural realities. For instance, that the fastest growing occupations for women are in the service industries, which are the lowest paid, least secure, and have few benefits. And the poverty rate for women has been the highest since 1993. And so she really doesn't see how the kind of lean-in message will work for a, for instance, a single mother who works at works for minimum wage at McDonald's. Okay, so I am pretty much with Faludi, and it's interesting because I actually had some of my students read excerpts from Sheryl Sandberg's book and Susan Faludi's critique of it, and then there was a class debate. And I allowed them to have two teams. One, you argue for Sandberg's lean in. The other, you you take Susan Faludi's view and critique lean in. And so so I asked them to go to opposite sides of the room. And guess which one had more students?
Susan's side.
I wish that were the case, but it was Sandberg's lean-in side. So so that's been a, that's been the case for several classes in which I've done this kind of debate exercise. So. So anyways, Rosalind Guild and Shani Orgad, the scholars I referred to earlier, say that the lean-in movement, Sandberg's lean-in movement, and these kinds of imperatives to women to be more confident, right? To take the reins, to not step back, to sort of work on yourself internally, right? So that you can advance at work. That this kind of focus on working on yourself internally, finding your own inadequacies, right? And then learning how to play the game better. Right. That Gill and Orgad believe that that lean in is part of this broader cultural confidence imperative to women. And they call it cultures of confidence. And so they believe that confidence imperatives to women, like things that that tell women that they need to speak up more. They're too shy. They need to increase their confidence. They have to, they have to take power poses, fake it till they make it, right? So even if they don't feel confident inside, they have to seem confident. That they believe that this obscures and prevents people from identifying and working together to change the real relations of power. Because they believe that the problem and the solution to inequality do not stem from the internal inadequacies of women, of individual women, and their lack of will to advance in their careers. And that we need to get beyond that. So, so that is... one of the kind of directions that I sometimes see sort of feminism going these days, like exhortations about women's empowerment, right? Sort of take back your confidence, right? Things like that. So I see that. Of course, I see the benefits of it. Of course, it's good to tell women and girls to be confident. But when it comes to actually changing where inequality, right, structural inequality, then we need to look outside of ourselves. Another area of interest for me is how cultural works and discourses represent bearing and birthing children, as well as motherhood. And this is particularly pressing now, of course, given the Dobbs case that effectively overturned Roe versus Wade. I had some students in a class watch the first episode of the streaming series, The Handmaid's Tale, right, based on Margaret Atwood's dystopian novel of the same name. And so are we familiar with either the series or the novel? Okay, so this scenario of forced surrogacy and childbirth by a large forced surrogacy and childbirth in The Handmaid's Tale struck a major chord with a lot of women in the years following Trump's election, and it still resonates today. It was Trump's appointed conservative Supreme Court justices who were instrumental in making the Dobbs decision. Women in much of the U.S. are already experiencing the dystopia of unwanted and forced pregnancy. Conservatives, often men, but women as well, downplay the serious risks of pregnancy and childbirth in favor of what they describe as saving the innocent life of the unborn baby. Women are, according to conservatives, are naturally made to bear children and have done it successfully for thousands of years. And I just want to say, this isn't only something that, you know, conservatives say. This is also something that, for instance, proponents of the natural birth movement, they also say that. As one conservative politician, the Ohio Republican Bill Dean, said, "The maternal mortality rate is so high in the U.S. because so many American women are overweight and don't care for their bodies adequately, leading to serious pregnancy complications." So women just need to all get together and lose more weight, right? And then the maternal mortality rate will go down, according to Bill Dean. So it's things like this. It's the kind of anodyne, even idealization of pregnancy, and childbirth, not just by conservatives, but, by a number of cultural discourses. And it's everywhere. It's in movies, it's in manuals, it's when you talk to your friends, it's on online discussion boards, the idealization of pregnancy, gestation, and childbirth is something that I feel like we need to actually talk more about and reconfigure, and we need to talk more about the serious risks, the life and death matter that is pregnancy. And I think that means that even what happens during the average pregnancy is not represented in a way that shows all of the things that happen to the pregnant body. And so I feel like there is a lack of knowledge. There's a kind of cavalier attitude when it comes to, women getting pregnant. Well, of course, you're carrying a life. Afterwards, you can just give it up for adoption. But I think there needs to be sort of more of an emphasis on how pregnancy is a serious medical condition. And there are some cultural discourses that have been cropping up that have been sort of representing pregnancy differently. And I think that those more of these are needed. Just as an example, sorry, I'm trying to find something. Okay. Okay, so there is this this biologist named Susan Sadadin, and she wrote a piece about pregnancy. Which I think is quite the opposite of representing it as some kind of smooth, anodyne, natural experience. So I'm just going to read a little bit from her piece, which I found really interesting as another way of thinking about or conceiving of pregnancy. It's called War in the Womb, a ferocious biological struggle between mother and baby belies any sentimental ideas we might have about pregnancy. Okay, let me just try to find the excerpt. All right. For most mammals, this is Susan Sadadin, despite the underlying conflict, life goes on almost as normal during pregnancy. They flee from predators, capture prey, build homes, and defend territories, all while gestating. Even birth is pretty safe. They might grimace or sweat a bit during labor, but that's usually the worst of it. There are exceptions. Hyena mothers, for example, give birth through an impractical penis-like structure, and about 18% of them die during their first delivery. But even for them, pregnancy itself is rarely perilous. If we look at primates, however, it's a different story. Primate embryos can sometimes implant in the fallopian tube instead of the womb. When that happens, they tunnel ferociously towards the richest nutrient source they can find. The result is often a bloodbath. And among the great apes, things look even dicier. Here we start to see perhaps the most sinister complication of pregnancy, preeclampsia, a mysterious condition characterized by high blood pressure and protein discharge in the urine. Preeclampsia is responsible for around 12% of human maternal deaths worldwide, but it's very much just the start of our problems. A list of the reproductive ills that afflict our species might start with placental abruption, hyperemesis gravidarum, gestational diabetes, cholestasis, and miscarriage, and carry on from there. In all, about 15% of women suffer life-threatening complications during each pregnancy. Without medical assistance, more than 40% of hunter-gatherer women never reach menopause. Even with the help of modern medicine, pregnancy still kills about 800 women every day worldwide. So this is what I found to be a really interesting way of representing what is actually happening to the pregnant body. In most mammals, the mother's blood supply remains safely isolated from the fetus. It passes its nutrients to the fetus through a filter which the mother controls. The mother is a despot. She provides only what she chooses, which makes her largely invulnerable to paternal manipulation during pregnancy. In primates and mice, it's a different story. Cells from the invading placenta digest their way through the endometrial surface, puncturing the mother's arteries, swarming inside and remodeling them to suit the fetus. Outside of pregnancy, these arteries are tiny, twisty things spiraling through depths of the uterine wall. The invading placental cells paralyze the vessels so they cannot contract, then pump them full of growth hormones, widening them tenfold to capture more maternal blood. These fetal cells are so invasive that colonies of them often persist in the mother for the rest of her life, having migrated to her liver, brain, and other organs. There's something they rarely tell you about motherhood. It turns women into genetic chimeras. Okay, so that's just a little excerpt from an article that I highly recommend by Susan Saddedin. Okay. And so I don't really have a sort of way to finish this talk because I don't have the answers to stemming the tide of feminism at risk. But I do think that some of these things that I've been talking about are just kind of ways of shifting cultural representations. Right. I think can possibly shift the overall public discourse in a way that that understands right the difficulties of pregnancy and also how the confidence culture is not always a good thing for women. It prevents them from working collectively to really change the oppressive structures of power.
Linda, would you like to open it up to questions or discussions about what you've presented? Would that be a way you'd like to go now?
Sure.
Okay. All right. So we have until noon to focus on Linda and what she has brought to us. And if there are comments or questions, we can do that now until 1 o'clock. Thank you, Linda. And I guess I'll start with a comment. You know, I was listening to the Sandberg Faludi debate that you were saying, and it made me think of what's happening in movements of Black people. So I know a number of very strong statements that have been made that say, listen, you're the oppressors, we have suffered, we're not going to lead you out of this, and we're not going to give more of our emotional capital and our efforting capital to train you how to be different. You need to learn that, and you need to figure it out. And I was hearing those voices as you were saying that Sandberg seems to be saying the opposite. No, it's inside of you. You have to change yourself, as opposed to what would it be like to say to patriarchal systems and men to say, you figure it out. You figure it out how you can treat us equally. You figure out where the mistakes are that you've made. You do the work. We're done. We're done. We're the oppressed, and it's your job. So I just wanted to reflect that similarity that I was hearing.
Yeah, that's a really interesting similarity. I have heard that from people of color, right? Like, they're just so exhausted of just explaining things, explaining why things are so wrong in this country, explaining racism, right? That that they just say, you know, to people, you know, it's your duty to find out, right? You find out, right? Yeah. Why it's wrong and what's wrong. And I feel like it's with the Faludi, I think what she's saying is not so much, well, the people in power go figure it out, right? Figure out how to rectify these structural inequities. I think that she thinks that women collectively, they know, and they can kind of work together to fight these oppressive structures.
Right, and being told that they didn't cause it. Right. Yeah, it's a little different. Any other comments or questions? Paula.
Linda, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And I have to say that when you were talking about the very beginning, being in academics and having to work harder, I worked in academics for a long time. My husband was a scientist at Harvard. And what you were telling me that's happening now was the same in the 70s and 80s. And I'm like, should I be depressed? Yes. And I appreciate your willingness to be so honest. I had a friend who worked so hard. She had one child with her husband. They were all in on it, and all in meaning all cooperating, and it was still very hard. So I appreciate your willingness to be honest and your comparison of Lean In and Susan Faludi. I have to say, I'm just going to say a very personal comment. When Sheryl Sandberg came out with Lean In, I was trying to figure out how to slow down so that I could have a life. And that Lean In was like, I don't know. So I appreciate your critique of it very much. And of the structure, I don't know what to say, but I appreciate you bringing it out and talking about it. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Paula.
Mary Margaret.
I am got the sun coming in my room here. I'm not sure whether I'm going to say something that is a dated comment. So I'm interested in your thoughts, Linda, and what you might know of those of your students. But it seems that, I don't know, back in the day, it was very hard for women to get together on something like this. Always that feeling of, you know, I don't want to lose what I have. And the old stereotypes of, you know, cat fights and just women not being able to get along to get something done. And I want, I don't know, maybe other people, can chime in on that, but I'm wondering, what is it like among younger people today and people, you know, your age? Do you sense that women could really get together or are they suspicious of one another you know, not being able to go forward.
I don't really know if I know really the answer to that question, but I do think that I think there's a lot of there's a lot of anger and dissatisfaction among women. Not sure. I think among young women too. But just among women with children, I think that they are willing to get together. There are groups that are just fed up with the terrible way that the childcare system is set up in this country to just overlook early childhood, which are, you know, some of the most important developmental years. And so there are women working together to change that, to lobby the government, for better childcare policies, and so I do think things are happening, and also I don't know if any of you remember, but there was a news story about these moms during the COVID pandemic, and they got together in a field and they just screamed at the top of their lungs. It was like a primal scream, right? Like that they just had it, right? With all of the things that they were being asked to do without support of any kind. And so it's like that kind of thing, right? I think women are angry, and I think they want to come together and change things. That's my impression.
Thank you.
Muna has her hand up too.
Where is Muna? And then Martha. Where's Muna? Oh, there you are. Muna, yeah.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thank you.
I never see those symbols. I only see people's actual hands. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Hi, Linda. Thank you for that excellent talk. And I'm really, you know, nice to see you in person. Sorry, not in person.
Hi, Muna.
Virtually. We haven't met
yet.
Yeah,
right. It's a pleasure meeting you. We just met through email.
We've only met through email. But anyway, I was really glad you were able to do this talk. So that's great. I was just so surprised about what you said about your students, like going in not being in the Beluda corner, you know, being in the Sheryl Sandberg corner. And I was wondering if you think, I mean, we know that there's a major mental health crisis going on among young people, right? Especially teen girls, you know, that they have they're at higher risk for suicide than ever before, I think. I don't, you know, or maybe someone has better details, but do you think it is these incessant messages from society, like about that if anything is wrong or if you're not succeeding to these very high goals that society sets for you, that it's your fault, that it's your weakness, that you have to, you know, clean up your act and improve, like, and yeah, so I'm curious, like, what were this like subsequent conversations? And I was wondering if you could just go in a little bit more into depth about that, about your analysis of that phenomena.
My analysis of which phenomena?
Oh, your the way that your students reacted in class, and whether you think that's related to like, you know, mental health and messaging to young people. That's.
Yeah, that's really interesting question. So, I think the ones who flock to the lean in Sheryl Sandberg side, I feel like they think they believe it's true that women, you know, tend to be more quiet. They tend to sort of not sit at the table and, you know, be less confident than men. And so they don't see anything wrong with kind of learning how to change those things, right? To seem more confident, to sit at the table, to kind of be more vocal, right? About reaching for opportunities and things like that. So I think they think that that's all really, really good, right? Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, you know, if they're not able to do those things, then what? Then is it like, you know, a fault of their own, right? They weren't able to be confident enough, right? Or you know, maybe they just they reach as much as they could for that career advancement opportunity and just didn't get it, right? Would that be seen as kind of like a personal failing, is like not trying hard enough? Mm-hmm. And so perhaps I'm thinking maybe that could be related to how young people just put a lot of pressure on themselves individually to measure up to things. And then when they don't, right, it's all on them, right? They're not encouraged to look at other structures, right, that and other obstacles that might be limiting them. So, yeah.
Well, it's good that you're kind of pointing them in that direction too, you know, because, yes, everyone can try to work to improve themselves too, but they also have to feel a bit of the need for collective action to address, you know, the structural inequalities in society, right? And if they don't recognize that and they don't feel it, you know, things aren't going to get better within the multiple crises we're facing. So, yeah, it's good you're getting them thinking in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah. Martha.
Yes. Hi there. I'm new to the group. Barb.
Welcome.
Barb invited me, so this is my first visit, and I was just kind of lurking. I'm a retired speech language pathologist, and I don't know if any of you have read the book You Just Don't Understand by Louise Tannen, but she talks about how men and women communicate. And I think that women are lateral consensus builders and men are hierarchical. My toy is bigger than your toy. And when you put those two axes together, you have a very small, finite area where there can be real communication in terms of, I'm really hearing what you're saying. And I have found that to be one of the most important things that when I'm dealing as a school speech pathologist with a male principal and accused of advocating for the children, trying to look at how he saw the hierarchy of the school with the children being at the very bottom, that I found that to be most helpful in listening to what they said. I had a number of male and female principals that I worked under, but it was really the understanding the hierarchical viewpoint. And I think that when you look socially at all of the systems that we work in, it's getting better, but very few of them are lateral and consensus building. They are mostly hierarchical, which is what men are most comfortable with. So in terms of looking at how we shape our response, if they can divide and conquer and tell us that we have catfights in response to somebody's comment about, you know, that there wasn't a sense that women could get together. The only time they got together was when they were fighting. That's a male perception that women have accepted. We don't have to accept that. So I just wanted to put that out there that, you know, there's very limited window of opportunity, and it takes a lot of energy to communicate, as we are seeing politically, with people that really are not listening. And we've got to figure out how, at the way women function, how do we make that more hierarchical without being punitive?
So. Thank you. So, Linda, do you need to leave right now?
Yeah, I do. I have to. I have to go to a class.
Can I just ask Linda one question?
Sure.
The class that where you had the debate between Sandberg and Faludi. What was the name of that course that you were teaching?
It was called Sociology of Popular Culture.
Okay. I was just curious. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you so much.
For coming here.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for having me.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. See you later, Linda. Maybe on campus one day.
Yes. Yes. Maybe I can meet you in person, too.
That would be lovely. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Bye-bye.
Good to see you. Thank you.
So it's time for us to shift to our discussion portion of today. And we started off with Barb Vilandri giving us a tour of women's history and progression through the last 50, 60 years. And there might be some reflections you want to do with that. And then we heard from Linda, and you might want to bring some of those points up as well. So we're here together till 1:30. Yeah, Marcia.
So many thoughts are going through my mind. Barbara, thank you so much for your wonderful, cohesive history for many of us. But I wanted to respond to Linda, and I'm sorry that she left. What I've noticed with women who are climbing the ladder is that what they have in the past anyway, I don't know how it is right now, they just are in patriarchal school. and they're just joining the patriarchy, and they're patriarchs in skirts. And some of them are, who I've met are pretty difficult to get along with. And I don't know if that was similar with some of the principles that the other woman was talking about. So that's just a point. And that was something that I never wanted to be, was a patriarch in a skirt. I just wanted to be a human being. If I'm in charge of several people, I think of the circle as a better geometric form than the pyramid. And people in the 70s, we were talking about things like that, and it seemed to have gotten lost in the 80s, because everything was about money, it seemed like, in the 80s. The one with the most money was the winner. And I just think we've gotten off track, because we're forgetting that people are souls, and that we're, each one of us is on a soul's journey, in my opinion. And whether we like it or not, I think we are, whether we know it or not, whether we're mindful or not. But I think that some women really sell their souls to go up the corporate ladder. So that's an opinion. Just want to throw it out.
Thank you, Marcia. It goes to my point in a way. What I was trying to say, maybe not very well, was if we could ask men to be accountable, to sit in a room and listen to each other, is it possible that there are some men with a higher degree of female anima in them, a little less testosterone or a little less conditioning, that would be able to say to the other men, how are we going to create an environment which welcomes what women have to offer? And how are we going to treat them equally? And I think that I would like to hold them more responsible in that way, to have that conversation, and to trust that there's a range of sensibilities within men that could have that conversation, instead of feeling like the women have to get louder and more confident and use their voices and push their way through. It's like, well, there's another piece that can happen. So, yeah. Barb, and then someone else. Does someone else have their hand up? And Paula.
And Lindsay, you know, that would depend on the group dynamics of the men that are together.
Absolutely.
Because in the right group dramatics, that could never happen, and in the right one, it could.
Right. Yes. What I will take responsibility is to be mothers who raise sons who have more anima in them. So that eventually that boardroom conversation could work. But yes, I totally understand what you're saying, and kick them out of the military on top of it. But Paula.
I just wanted to say that, you know, when Linda Liu brought up the cultural message of, you know, women can just work on it internally and get a better voice, get more confidence. That's a message that I thought that I grew up with and for many years. But then when I came upon the obstacle was the structural patriarchy, the patriarchy, the structure, which was so heavy-handed, and starting with how much I was paid, you know. And yes, the pay gap is better now, but that structure, the social structure, the patriarchal structure is still in place. And when George Floyd was killed and we started to talk about structural racism and that whole thing, I really brought it out again how much the patriarchy is still in place. And I think that the George Floyd, the movement that happened after George Floyd was for the benefit. We needed that movement in many ways, not just as for the blacks, but for all of us. So I'm not depressed today, but you could get real depressed that the message is still the same. She's talking about the message the social message of make yourself better internally, when in fact there's a lot of structural obstacles.
Yes. Yes. Who else had their hand up? Was there somebody else? Yes, Martha. And then Dorianne, and then Charlene. You're muted.
Okay, there we go. I think that we, my blood type is B positive. So I am positive. And God's little gift to me. But I think that the people that are in the hierarchies are lessening because mothers have been raising socially and emotionally higher IQ sons.
Yes.
And I think that it is a gradual shift. The people that are in the hierarchies are probably not going to be the people that are going to sit down and say, let's see how we can figure this out. So the change has occurred generationally. I see more and more men in touch with their feminine realities. I think the trans movement in this country is pivotal to the men that are frightened of who they are and all the drag queen stuff. It's just, you're seeing the disintegration of the patriarchal movement. And by challenging them on all different fronts, we are seeing less and less of that patriarchal. I don't think it's continuing. So I am positive. You know, I see people nodding. So, and if you're all moms and you've had sons, then woohoo.
Nice. Dorianne.
Well, I grew up, I'm 78. I grew up with the idea that you had to be a wife and mother. You were Mrs. So-and-so, which is your husband's name and all that. And then when women became more assertive, et cetera, there was a new formula. You can have it all. You can be a wife, mother, and have a career. And I never became a wife and mother. And I had some interesting jobs which were beneficial to society. But the thing, I think that women need to be, people need to be seen as people. And without these formulas, because I remember some both married and unmarried women who were very good to me, and I have good memories of me, who were gentle and supportive. And it's people should be seen as individuals. I mean, this is true of any form of bigotry. You've got to see the person for their personality and their interests, etc. And you might end up being friends or you might not. But I hate the word spinster. It's almost like the N-word. But I guess I'm probably said enough that I just hated, I just could not fit a formula in my life. So, and those formulas can be very irritating.
Thanks, Doria. Charlene, and then Mary Margaret, and then I want to ask a question.
Well, I was thinking about the problem of maternal deaths in the United States and how one reason that was given that Linda mentioned was it's obesity. And it seems so obvious. It's a system of health that is all broken in our country.
A system of what, Charlene?
The system of health care in this country.